unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
It's wonderful to see so many of you this morning, and I see some new faces. Would you just put your hand up if you're here for the first time? Wonderful. Welcome. My name is Linda, and I practiced here many, many years ago, and I've been back for the past year, and will continue indefinitely. So, I'm practicing more or less indefinitely because I've been invited to be the next abbot. So then this is the first talk that I'm giving since I've been invited to be the next abbot. The newsletter article came out, so shared many of my feelings, of which was, for those of you who haven't read it yet, just the one thing I wanted to say is that the feeling of gratitude for your trust and support is just, it's really humbling. It's just, it's a little overwhelming sometimes. And I'm so grateful for the many things that I get to do, I'm asked to do in this role, because it keeps me very grounded, just in the day-to-day of moving forward together. Thank you all so much. When I read the, a couple of things that this talk seemed to want to, I had a talk going one very distinct direction, and in the last couple of days it decided that it wanted to do something else. So we'll see how this all fits together. Where to start, because I could start from any one of a number of places. But I'll start with this. When I read the position description for abbot, I was surprised at what a good match it was in many ways. I was like, that's kind of weird. And then I reflected on the 20 plus years that I spent training at San Francisco Zen Center, and Tassajara in particular, and I thought, you know, I'd always heard that it was really good training, but nobody seemed to know how to talk about it as training. Like, people were very confused, like, what is Zen training? Or like, this is just work or whatever. But it is the perfect training to lead a temple. It's just amazing. The range of roles that I had over 20 years, from being just on general labor when I first arrived, which, you know, after you've been there for a while, you realize what a gift it is. You just show up and the work leader says, would you please go clean the bathroom? You're like, yes. So simple. You don't need to think about anything. And gradually you get roles that involve some thinking and some feedback and some doing and some, anyway, so it's a different form of practice. And I think I appreciated all of them, but there are many aspects of practice that have, and training, that have become clear to me only since stepping out of that container, as I think often happens, to have the space to reflect when you're not right in it. And Sojin Roshi was always happy that Greg and I were there. He's like, that's good that you're there. I know exactly where you are all the time and what you're doing every hour of the day. And he loved Tassajara a lot. And he also loved that we were taking care of San Francisco Zen Center, taking care of the temple, making sure that it continued to be a resource and a refuge and a place of practice for times to come. And that was a form of his expression of gratitude to his teacher, Suzuki Roshi, who had founded San Francisco Zen Center, because he wanted to bring Zen to the West, to this country. So he felt like, yeah, that was his part of his responsibility. He was here, but he also became co-abbot of San Francisco Zen Center at a difficult time. So he was both for some years. Yeah. So when we were asked to come back to Berkeley Zen Center 1 year ago, it's like 1 year almost to the day, we arrived on August 31st last year. It was an easy yes. Yes, of course, we'll come to our home temple. And we were just at Tassajara again a week ago. We just got back on Monday. And again, it was a wonderful feeling in the valley. And partly because of some of the people that I was talking to when I was there, I was reflecting on what made it such a particularly wonderful feeling this summer. Some of the previous summers, especially since the pandemic, have been challenging. You know, not so many people coming back after the pandemic and doing a different model, and a lot of stretching for people in a lot of ways. And part of it was that they shifted their whole model, and that seems to be working really well this summer. So it took a while to find that. And it reminded me again that it, and this is one of the things I learned at my time at Tassajara in particular, it's not going to feel easy or right from the beginning if you're making changes. It's probably going to be uncomfortable. And that's okay. And it can smooth out. But learning to not freak out when things are uncomfortable or bumpy or not the way you wanted or not the way you'd expected, or you might be more or less okay, but other people are having difficult experiences, and to find some trust in a larger container, just because you've gone through many cycles of apparent chaos over and over again, because we shift roles, pretty much everyone together, a couple times a year. So everyone's in a new role, and it's just like, yeah, that's what it looks like. That's okay. And I think pretty much all organizations, all Zen centers, are going through some times of change and flux for various reasons, pandemic, world changing, whatever. But to keep coming back to that that fundamental trust in practice, place, and people has been really nourishing for me, and really supports me. So I was thinking about not just Zen practice, which I think is a lot of what people think about when they come here. You know, it's like Zazen. Zazen is Zen practice. But Zen training, and what's the difference between Zen practice and Zen training, or is there any difference? I think in terms of practice, maybe not. But when we think about Zen practice, I think our thoughts go to Zazen. When we think about Zen training, it's like, well, what's that? And because practice is how we approach everything, and the training is, I mean, you could say that it is everything. It's not just sitting on the cushion. It's serving and washing dishes and taking care of the garden and giving and receiving feedback and learning how to bow and learning how to do all the forms. And I think part of the training is that voluntarily place ourselves in a position where the maybe the fundamental practice, whenever possible, is to just say yes. I accept. I will. Yes, I will. In Japanese, the word hai is yes, and basically it's like, just say hai, I will. Can you please chop 3 gallons of carrots? Hai. Will you please do whatever? Hai. And then, and in a way, and that seems challenging. It is challenging. But then as you go along, you realize that there's another side to the practice, which is more challenging. If you're really all in, then you have to learn when to say no. And that can be difficult if you're a person who likes to say yes, and you're like, yes, I'm wholehearted about practice, but now there's too much because I keep saying yes. So now how do I discern? How do I balance? So all of these things, it's not one or the other, but it's how we approach each moment fresh, and yet with all of the practices and resources that we have developed over time, but not getting stuck on anything. And I was curious about what Suzuki Roshi had to say in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So, and I was also maybe curious to see if Sojin had written anything, as he likes to do in his books. So I went in the abbot's office, and he has a lovely first edition, very well worn and loved, of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And before I got really into it at all, I opened it up, and there was, this might have been lecture notes that he wrote. So I just wanted to share something of this. The heading is 4 aspects of practice. And above aspects, it says opportunities. So 4 opportunities for practice. And they are zazen, dokusan, work, and study. And next to each one where it says like zazen, it says my experience. And then dokusan, my experience. Work, my experience. Study, my experience. And then various other topics under that. And my first thought was like, so he's starting with his experience. It sounds a little self-centered, my experience. I thought, well, that's really what we have. Fundamentally, that's what we have, is our own experience. We don't have someone else's experience, we have our own. How is it for us? And that's what we base things on. And it's not about like elevating self or identity or saying that it doesn't exist or shouldn't exist. We all have a self, we all have an identity composed of many, many aspects. And if you just say, I let that all go, then we're neither relating so skillfully with ourselves or with others. Because then we can't see that our experience is different from theirs and their experience is different from ours. And that's really important to be aware of, especially if you're in this seat, but for everyone, for everyone. When we do what's called confession and repentance, you know, we say, all my ancient twisted karma, I now fully avow. This avow is to be, to find our upright posture in the midst of our own karmic conditioning. You know, say, yeah, this is who I am in this moment. This is who I've been in my life. And to turn toward it and not get stuck on it. So that's quite a practice right there. To not grab onto it and to not push it away. To not think we shouldn't be here. But this is the basic practice that we do with everything. So of course we're doing it with ourselves as well as with others. And the more that we can do this, we can find freedom with ourselves and within ourselves, and freedom in the world, because we're becoming increasingly less reactive to whatever arises. Within our own experience, our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings, it's like, oh, there are some interesting thoughts which are leading to excitement or suffering or disappointment or whatever it is. It's like, oh, there's that. Hello again. To have some warmth and gentleness. And to not try to get rid of it, but not hold on to it. That freedom, it's basically all about our own experience, because even if it's happening, you know, outside of us, it's happening inside of us. Whatever response we're having is happening inside of us, even though a person or what we read online or whatever it is happening apparently somewhere else, but we know about it in here. So this freedom, you know, in times when many freedoms are being undermined, this is the freedom that cannot be taken away from you. And it's also hard to maintain. It's a big challenge to maintain that kind of freedom. Because again, it takes some doing, it takes some effort, some turning toward, and it also takes some letting go. So, yeah, big, big challenges. And I was going to say big rewards, and I'm like, there's a better word here. And I'm like, right, it's the fruits of practice. This is the fruit of practice, is finding these touchstones of freedom, these touchstones of being. And this is really what Zen training is about, is setting up situations, various forms, zazen, dokusan, meeting with a teacher, work, and study. These are all opportunities to see oneself, to see others, to be present. And they're all different ways that we can explore that, because there isn't just one. It's not just about getting really good at zazen and finding complete freedom from zazen, but being trapped every time you get up from the cushion. It's like, how do we extend zazen mind throughout our life? And beyond that, how do we share that with others? How do we find that equanimity in ourselves that we can share that with others just by our presence? Maybe we want to talk about it. Maybe someone wants to hear from us about it. But also just being that is probably the most powerful thing. So Sojin had another piece of paper in his book, and this was divided into two pieces, two parts. One was sitting, and the other was movement. And under that, he had walking, working, one with the activity. And yeah, I like that, because a lot of times people can get confused about work practice. And you know, that was one of the four areas that I had read that's very traditional in Zen training and Zen monasteries, is work. And it wasn't always so, for sure. In Buddha's time and in India generally, monks did not work, period. could not work, could not handle money, received alms and for food once a day. When Buddhism went to China, that did not work. Very different culture. So huge change for Buddhism to be able to come to China and be taken up, because then the monks started working. They were farming and they were taking care of their own food. They weren't being served anymore. There's a lot of work. I can tell you from living at Tassajara, there's a lot of work to do just to take care of a community of people living together. And we were not farming. So, you know, we had food brought in, but you still have to cook it and prepare it and serve it and, you know, all the maintenance things. And I was thinking about Sojin talking about his experience of work practice. And Sojin loved work practice. And I think that was a really big, a big part of his practice. At Tassajara, during practice periods, there was always one day in a monastic week that was a work day, where we worked all day. And he loved working in the shop and doing wood projects. And he'd been a painter, both fine art and house painting and varnishing. He loved all of that. And my dad was really into working with his hands, and I think I picked that up from him, you know, that affinity for that. Although my dad worked in an office, he worked with numbers all day. And I think that kind of work at home was grounding for him. And I've been reflecting for years on how the meaning and the significance or the importance of work seems to have changed generationally among people who've been coming to Tassajara, San Francisco Zen Center. You know, my mom and dad grew up during the Depression. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And it wasn't grind culture then. It was really different. So just the association with work or with certain activities can be like, I don't want to do that. You know, that's definitely not what I'm looking for. That's not where it's at. The associations are really powerful, I think, for some people, not for all people, but and depending on what culture you grew in or what part of the country or where you came from, what your background was, what your family values are, can have very different relationships with just that word, work. What does it mean? And which is why I was happy to see like movement. We talk about, maybe it's skillful to talk about movement practice or practice and activity, practice off the cushion. Because probably most people wouldn't think of serving our formal Oriyoki breakfast on Saturday mornings as being work. You know, but if you're at Tassajara and you're on some crew, you're definitely on some crew, and that's your work. But if you start thinking of all the things that we do here that aren't sitting or ceremonies, or maybe, you know, the delightful conversation over tea and cookies after the talk, then I think two things happen. One is that you may miss opportunities to explore what practice looks like in other areas. Like what is, like if you're washing the dishes, if you're cleaning up the teacups after the talk, how can that be an offering or a, my mom used to love to wash the dishes. So she just, you know, it was just very, not a meditator by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it was very meditative for her. It was very familiar, it was very repetitive, and when it was done, it was done. And it had a nice closure to it. She's in the rack, dry them off, mop everything down, done, satisfied. I never liked dishes. Because for me, they came with my mother's anxiety and control about exactly how I did it. So it took me a while to learn to, you know, being out of the house, to enjoy dishes and enjoy simple activities like that without getting so much of my own stuff, my conditioning involved in it. So one side is the practice of engaging with anything as practice, finding freedom within whatever, and in a genuine way, not like some of the tech companies are like, let's do meditation because then you're all very focused and doing your work better. And it's not about that, it's about freedom. And because we're all finding freedom together in a tradition and a place and a way that is very focused on community. Sangha is the community. Doing things together, doing things in harmony, which can feel so good. Like if you get to serve with the same serving crew at Tassajara, and we eat orioki 3 times a day, every day, and you're working with the same, you know, 4 or 5 other people, you get really in harmony and it's so satisfying. It's like doing a dance together, you know, and you get it kind of clicked in. You know, it's like how to do that. But there's, you know, lots of ways we can find harmony with each other. How do you move around the kitchen together without bumping into each other, without getting irritated, but doing the kitchen dance in a crowded space when you're pressed for time? You know, you're doing this dance together. So I would encourage any or all of you, if you haven't already, to sign up for some of the other roles, like being a server or learning to play the bells or be kokyo, doing the chants for service, or washing dishes, whatever it is. And to approach it specifically with a mind of practice, like, how can this be practiced? How can I practice with this in this moment? What's arising for me? What's in front of me? Who else is around me? Who am I relating to and how? And if you've been doing those for a while, one of the most amazing way to learn more about something is to teach it, to share it. So if you're willing to take more of a leadership role, let someone know, someone who's wearing a robe like this or a raga suit. Because it's really, I found that I do things for others. I show up for others in ways that I often don't for myself. You know, there's another person there and I genuinely want to support them and help them. And something is called forth in doing that, in working together. So all of these are really, really deep opportunities for practice. One of the other things that taking care of the temple does is it creates this kind of web of care and attention that can really be felt. Can be felt by others when they enter a space. So many people, you know, I live right upstairs over there. So I see people like peering in the gate or wandering around sometimes, and they want to know what this place is. And they all comment how good it feels. You know, the gardens are really well kept. Thank you, Mira. And everyone who also helps with that. I mean, Nora can't do it by herself, for sure. It's like all the people who help with the gardening. And the Zendo is so well cared for. It's clean, but it goes somewhere beyond that. It receives care every day. Every day that it's open, it receives care. I used to play string instruments, mostly a bass, a string bass. And at a certain point in my life, I stopped playing and I kept the bass around for a while. But after a few years, I realized that I really needed to let it go and pass it on to someone who was actually playing it. Because instruments in particular wooden instruments, like string instruments, need to be played. There's something very important that happens with the wood cells, that it needs to be kept open. And if it doesn't have that, it gets kind of a dead tone. And I think the same is true for Zen centers, for temples, for Zendos, for places of practice, that it needs to have that care and love extended into it, and that is palpable. I did mention I didn't much care for a long time for washing dishes, neither did I care for cleaning because, my mom. and then, I guess it was my third summer at Tassajara when we were supporting the guest season, so it's mostly work in the summer. Morning and evening zazen, but the day was a full day of work. And I was asked, I was really thinking that I was going to be the head doan, which is all ceremonial. I'd been on the doan Rio, I thought that was going to be good. And I was asked to be the head of cabin crew, housekeeping. And I did my very best to be encouraging and inspiring from people and to take it up completely. But what shifted for me was a student who came, fortunately, like right at the beginning of guest season. And she wanted to be on cabin crew. I'm like, tell me why. and she had originally come as a guest. And she told me which cabin she'd been in so I could just picture it, you know, a little redwood cabin on the creek. And she said when she first walked in, she had this feeling of, light and cleanliness and order and just how everything was taken care of. Like she could see that, although it's old, that it was well cared for. And that touched her so much and she felt like, I really want to be able to give that experience to other people. I want to be on cabin crew so I can be part of that kind of offering. And that really opened my eyes to the possibility that pretty much anything that we do can be done as an offering, can be done with generosity, can be done as practice. Even when it's not obvious, even when it's not easy. And sometimes I think, especially when it's not easy, because if I had also loved cleaning, and I have friends who do, that's their kind of happy place or their calming place. It's like I'm stressed out, I'm gonna clean the entire house. Then it's just something that you like. But when it's something that you have to work for a little bit, maybe a lot, something shifts, something changes. So that willingness to take up something can be very profound. It's what makes it a practice and what makes it effective. So I want to leave some time for questions. Thank you very much. You may have questions, or you may just want to share your experience. And now, if you can move that just a little closer so I can see people.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your talk. I wanted to circle back to this yes and no practice, this yes, I will, and then being around longer, and maybe if you're the kind of person who has to learn to say no. And just to add something that surgeon said to me on more than one occasion, which was when you're saying yes to, excuse me, to something, you're saying no to something else. When you're saying no to something, you're saying yes to something else. So it's never, right, just one or the other. It's realizing what the yes is for and what the no is for.
Yes.
And thank you for saying yes.
I'm really practicing with saying no to wasting time. Anyone else? Anyone online?
Thank you, Linda. When you were talking, there were a number of things you spoke about that I'm interested in that, or ooh, I don't like that. It's kind of back and forth. Well, much more on the, oh yeah, I like that. But one of the things when you're talking about work, and when you're at Tassajara, you're working, training, that you're doing this training. And I felt from early on, I'm doing some training, but what I saw it is simply my practice is training, getting up and coming and sitting, seeing something that needs to be done and doing it. Or getting help with it. So the longer you talked, I started realizing that even with the yes, no, and pretty much everything, I sort of look at it as, used to it was practice, I'm practicing, and when someone would say something about, oh my God, I can't believe you're doing that, and I said, it's called a practice, it's not called a perfect, and I'm practicing, so, you know, I'm just gonna keep doing that. But there's been this addition of participating that I feel like that when I think about saying yes or saying no, or when I think about what I like or what I don't like, I return to, am I participating? And I don't mean specifically with the thing, but I mean overall, it's kind of like interchangeable with practicing. And that's what I started thinking about when you were talking, is that there's a participation, and that will shift with me if I can slow down for a moment and think, why do you want to say yes? Why do you want to say no? And where's the participation? That, so anyway, it really made me think a lot about, because it did kind of, I just felt like, well, I'm working and I'm training. So it was really good to hear the whole thing. And yes, we all are. Is that you've got to learn how to do all that extra stuff. So, thank you for taking that on. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's easy to say yes here because I trust the person or the community asking me to say yes. And even if I don't know it at the time, I trust it. It's coming from a good place, and I, you know, it is nourishing in some capacity, even if I don't immediately understand that. That's much more challenging outside of a community like this. Can you talk a little bit about practice, how to decide yes and no outside of this community?
I think in many ways it's the same, especially about the yes, no, and the discernment. I mean, I think the heart of practice is the same, but it's funny, since you've asked, like, what's the difference, I'm finding more about what's the same. Like, you might want to do something, out in the world, and it's like, this takes too much time, whatever. Or you might want to do something here, and it's like, but I don't have time. You know, so I think they're very much in relation, and because we have one body and 24 hours in a day and 7 days in a week, they have to be in some kind of balance. But if you're talking about just the wholehearted yes, you never know how it's going to turn out, for one. Someone can say, you know, this is going to be great. Trust me, I got you. And all kinds of things could happen, which maybe have nothing to do with either of you, but it can go south in a major way, right? And there are, you know, I would say, I think the practice is not about whether you're saying yes or no so much as finding wholeheartedness. You know, if you're asked to stay late at work and you really didn't want to, and you were told you were going to get off early and now you have to work through the evening or whatever, make up your own disappointment at work story. You know, don't have to make it up, right? How can you be wholehearted in a way that does not add to your discontent or suffering? You know, even if you don't really don't want to be there, think you shouldn't be there. Yeah. And if you really think you shouldn't be there, like what's going on is not wholesome, to think about how you do something else. And if it's not possible to do something else due to causes and conditions, how to make as much peace as you can with that without abandoning your heart and those you love. We have a couple questions online. Michael. Okay, we're gonna go to the next person, we'll come back to you, okay? Leslie and Jake. Hi. We all say hello.
Hi, hi, Lynn. A great talk. Oh. With work, I found that during Sashin work periods, I love the work usually, but it was very hard for me when the clapper sounded to end. And for example, I remember painting and I would have just a few square feet to finish and I was so tempted to keep going, but I saw others not doing, that was very hard for me. But after a while of doing it, many years of doing that, I began to see that beginnings and endings are just words, and it got at my compulsiveness to always want to finish things, which I have a kind of a drive to finish things, like so to see one thing through to the end. Well, for a while I was thinking I wasn't doing that, but after a while I kind of got that it's okay not to finish the painting. So thanks for bringing that up. I'm wondering if you have any feelings toward that yourself.
Yes, I mean, yeah, for me it was raking generally. It was like, but this is still, you know, and I still notice it in the morning at Soji here. It's like, but. Yeah. But isn't it amazing how something so tiny as just ending work when the clappers go can be such a window into like who we are, and such, you know, it's like one thing about doing these kind of roles or activities within the temple is the consequences of doing it right or wrong are both pretty low, you know, it's like a low bar. So it gives you a lot more space in which to explore, you know, and repetition. That's a main principle of Zen training, Zen practice. Zen is repetition, because you see it go around, it's like, oh, there go the clappers, and there I go again. How great. Now I can look. Now I can see. Now I can let go. Thank you. Michael, should we try again?
Yep, now it's working. It didn't let me unmute before. more of an observation than a question. You said something that stuck with me where you're like, this work practice is an opportunity to see yourself and see others. And it particularly made me think of, there's some jobs and some opportunities for work practice that for me, the ego trip arises of, but if I get this wrong, what will people think of me? Or if I mess this up, it's going to mess other people up and everybody's depending on me. I think Wrench and Bunce popped that bubble. She wrote a long time ago about her early experience at Tassajara saying, well, with work stuff, they'll give you 10 seconds of instruction and tell you you'll be fine. And then you learn how to do it right by doing it wrong. So it's interesting how all of these are just opportunities for awareness and practice, no matter what's arising, whether it's concern, ego-based concerns, or whether it's just, you know, this not liking, whatever it might be. So more of just a comment and observation. So thank you.
Marley.
Thank you, Linda Roshi, for your talk and everybody for your questions, which have been helpful for me. I wanted to particularly be grateful for that little four aspects piece that you picked up from Sojin's notes, because in many ways I feel like I'm sort of the opposite from that perspective, in that the work seems so immediately appealing. The chanting, the bowing, the dishwashing all felt like, ah. I think the first time I did real work practice, somebody said, give yourself to the task at hand. And I'm like, that seems great. And Zazen felt awful. And it's really having had, you know, it is teaching you the same stuff, right? It's that's been slowly leaking in to be like, can I respond to all this screaming to get up or to grit my teeth against discomfort, or without overdoing it either, that same, the yes, the no, and to balance that. This is, I think, really clarified the ways in which that very same process is what I've been very slowly learning to appreciate on the cushion. So, thank you.
I feel you. I had very similar experiences. Zazen was hard, and things that involved my body were much more accessible. Whether it was Tai Chi, and I used to be a massage therapist, and I used to feel like my hands are the smartest part of my body. Like, they know things, and if I get my mind involved, it's going to mess it up. So it's taken a while for me to learn how to then play well together. I saw somebody's hand over here. Linda.
Hi, thank you. Like everybody else, I'm just kind of reflecting back, and then more stuff comes out. When you first gave that list, Zazen, Doksan, work, and study, yep. My first thought was, oh, that sounds pretty mostly isolated, mostly individual, except for Doksan is one-to-one comp, but still that's only two people. Then you brought forth the togetherness of work practice. One of the things that I think has been happening in transition from, say, Japanese Zen to American Zen, and in this place from Sojin to Hozan to the first woman at Berkeley Zen Center, is more and more, less and less, I don't know, only being aware of that individual practice, and more the relationship practice. So finally, at the end of my speeches, for me, it's all relationship, like all the way every part of it is about connection and relationship, or maybe discovering what is love.
Exactly. Discovering what is love. We have maybe time for one more.
We've got one online.
Great. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Hello. Thank you. I very much, you know, I really would like to work on together and alone and as community on this freedom that can't be taken away. And I've heard, and the letting go and not getting stuck. And I've heard this notion, I'm much aware about, you know, sovereignty within, as it were. And I wonder if you have any more to say on, you know, this. You're holding on, or in some way you're holding on to freedom that can't be taken away, but you're letting go.
Yes. I can really, you know, my experience, you know, so everything on Dzogchen's my experience. I can really tell you what my experience is. And in one sense, I think the more specific we are about and honest about our own experience, the more other people can see, you know, it's like Rembrandt's self-portraits are extremely specific. And yet many people think, like art critics think, this is like the universal everyman. But the everyman is not a stick figure. It's like a particularity. So my own particularity of that is that when I get tangled in whatever form of bondage, non-freedom, suffering happens to be coming up at the moment, what eventually works when I remember it, because it's so counterintuitive, it's going against the stream, against the karmic stream, is to turn fully toward whatever is there and present and is, you know, as much as I can see in the moment, the root cause of what's going on and what I'm actually, but first, what I'm actually feeling. What is my literal experience of it? What's the energy of it? How is it painful? How is it sticky? And the more I've been willing to turn toward that and be intimate with the parts of my experience that I tried so hard to get away from, much harder than I tried to get away from dishes and house cleaning. You know, it was a life project to get away from that. And when I got really, really close to succeeding, I found myself searching for what I'd lost of myself. And I had to go back and find it. So that's my path, just that turning toward what's most difficult, but not with my head, not trying to figure it out, because that's where I kept going wrong. I kept explaining it to myself and sometimes to others, and it never worked and it left me more dissatisfied. But to just let it be, let my heart be broken in that moment, because then things started to move. They went from being stuck to moving. And in that movement, there was new life. Many, many years ago, when I started finding my way in this, it usually took a good cry and a long nap. And then I'd wake up with some refreshment, and the world was fresh. And I felt connected to myself, and I felt connected to others. And my hands were open again. They weren't like this, and they weren't like this. So for me, that's been my path. But I think somewhere, you know, each of us knows where we have to go and what we need to do. And I think that's our way seeking mind, and it's what's brought all of us here today. And we may go away and come back and go away and come back, but there's something in us that knows. And to just through all the confusion and the upset, to find our way back to that little thread of, it's something over here, not there. And then we get a little closer. And we, it really helps to do it together. Thank you. And that's it. Thank you very much.